I jumped up uttering a sharp exclamation of surprise, which caused Madame to laugh inordinately. She said banteringly, "You will not go far on the path of occultism if you are so easily startled at a little thing like that." Then she presented me to the visitor, who proved to be he who is now the Master Jewel Cull, although he had not then taken the initiation which made him an adept. P. 68. Charles W. Leadbeater. Most mainstream scientifically oriented ufologists would probably regard these type of studies and discussions as irrational, meaningless or New Age nonsense. But I have noticed how several investigators of UFO and paranormal phenomena after years of research come to realize that the materialist, reductionist worldview is untenable. Like John Keel, they turn from phenomena to philosophy in their search for answers. Ufologist Amy Michelle expressed it this way to his friend Jacques Vallée: "Ufology is not a science but a process of initiation. One starts with field investigation and ends up studying Arab mystics." I agree with Michelle but would change Arab mystics to the esoteric tradition. Guides and mentors, Alice Bailey. As a young student in 1971, I was browsing the shelves in the antiquarian section of Anderson's Book Handle, Anderson Bookshop, in Norrköping. My eyes caught the title Telepathy, written by Alice Bailey. I bought the book and was immediately fascinated by its content, although there was much that was beyond my understanding and knowledge at the time. After acquiring some further titles by Alice Bailey, I enrolled as a student in the Arcane School in 1972. Receiving the student papers light on the path, I began meditation and study with the help of my personal secretary at the school. I kept this up for about 1 year, but as I also had the ordinary school to attend and being chairman of the local UFO society, I resigned from the Arcane School in 1973. This was my first acquaintance with the Alice Bailey books, which I would later continue studying all my life. Parts of my Alice Bailey collection. There are today literally hundreds of metaphysical systems and schools and thousands of channeled messages from various exotic entities. Cults and New Age societies are constantly being formed based on these messages, while scholars are doing their best trying to document the new groups and ideologies, with their many offshoots. At Archives for the Unexplained, AFU, we have large collections of channeled messages, especially from space people. They are usually exceedingly boring to read, a combination of well-meaning platitudinous comments and naive love, and light mysticism. It is fully natural and reasonable that academic scholars and intellectuals being confronted with such wisdom become even more skeptical of this genre and find secular humanism or materialist reductionism a better alternative. The critical and scientifically minded student will eventually, if persistent, in this jungle of conflicting messages and teachers, discover that there is a philosophy and tradition of equality vastly different from the popular New Age channelings. It is referred to as the esoteric tradition or ancient wisdom and can be regarded as the third intellectual force or pillar in cultural history alongside religion and science. One of the foremost exponents of this philosophy or science of the multiverse is Alice Bailey. In other blog entries, I have asserted that accepting esotericism as a worldview or paradigm does not imply rationalism or a loss of intellectual integrity. In the esoteric tradition as represented by A.O. Helena Blavatsky, Alice Bailey and Henry T. Lawrence, we find a philosophy that is consistent and rational with a profound humanism at its core. It also constitutes the best and most interesting multiverse paradigm and theory available to explain the multitude of intriguing UFO and paranormal phenomena documented by many researchers. Esotericism as presented by Alice Bailey is definitely on the side of modernity, democracy, social democracy, gender equality, human rights and politically more left than right wing. She also wished to give more balanced description of the adepts, the custodians of the ancient wisdom. They will stand forth as living examples of goodwill, of true love, of intelligent applied wisdom, of high good nature and humor, and of normalcy. They may indeed be so normal that recognition of what they are may escape notice. The externalization of the hierarchy, p. 699. Alice Bailey was for many years the amanuensis for the Tibetan, who dictated several of her books. He was given the name Jekyll, D.K., but that is not his real name. When first contacted and asked for cooperation, Alice told the Tibetan, "Certainly not. I'm not a darn psychic and I don't want to be drawn into anything like that." The unfinished autobiography of Alice A. Bailey, 163. She had noted that many metaphysical and spiritualist writings were of so low an order of intelligence and mediocre in their content that educated people laugh at them and cannot be bothered to read them. Eventually she did give it a try as she found the quality of the esoteric philosophy dictated by the Tibetan of a high order. Alice Bailey. The Tibetan asserts that he is secretary and organizing contact man to the inner world government or planetary guardians. Discipleship in the New Age, p. 33. He often refer to his access to the esoteric archive, library and museum maintained by the adepts, mentioned in several books by Blavatsky, Alcott and Leadbeater. "I but present the facts as I know them from my access to records more ancient than any known to man." Esoteric Psychology, Volume 1, p. 394. A problem with the Bailey books, Theosophy and Esotericism in general, is the abstruse and confusing terminology. The Tibetan is very much aware of this problem. A new and deeper esoteric terminology is badly needed. Telepathy and the Etheric Vehicle, 131. This problem has been brilliantly solved by the eminent Swedish esotericist Henry T. Lawrence in his presentation of Esotericism or the Science of the Multiverse. Another problem with the Bailey literature is the constant use of Christian terminology and references. Words and expressions like God, the return of Christ, etc. should have been abolished and a more neutral or scientific language used. Alice Bailey probably favored the Christian terminology because of her background as an Orthodox Christian missionary, but these expressions will have a deterrent effect on students with an agnostic or non-Christian background. The investigator of UFO and paranormal phenomena will, in the books by Alice Bailey, find an enormous amount of data regarding various phenomena and entities. I find it somewhat amazing that neither ufologists nor esotericists have noted that in the writings of Bailey there are many references to an awaited extra-terrestrial intervention mentioned before 1946. I have found no less than 34 references on this subject in her books. Here are a few examples from The Externalization of the Hierarchy, Cloth-Bound Ed. 1981, April 1935. The regenerative forces of those extraplanetary beings who offer their help at this time. P. 25, April, May 1940. Hovering today within the aura of our planet are certain great spiritual forces and entities, awaiting the opportunity to participate actively in the work of world redemption, re-adjustment and reconstruction. The waiting extra planetary forces. P. 222-223, September 1940, there still remains one mode of intervention which is still more mysterious, illimitably more powerful, and definitely more difficult to evoke and subsequently to contact. This is the emergence, response, or appearing of great sons of God who dwell in sources far removed from our planetary life altogether. P. 261, April 1943, certain great energies of extra-planetary significance who stand ready to intervene. P. 392. The books by Alice Bailey constitute an intellectual challenge. They are not easy to read, but why should the science of the multiverse be easier to understand than any academic discipline? It takes years of intensive study and hard work to be an accomplished esotericist. Mainstream academics and intellectuals will probably not consider esotericism as a working hypothesis or paradigm until definite empirical evidence indicates a multiverse. Until then, esotericism will be the domain of scientific heretics and iconoclasts in the cultural underground. The philosophical attitude to esoteric philosophy has been formulated by the Tibetan. Our attitude should be that of reasonably inquiry and our interest that of the investigating philosopher, willing to accept a hypothesis on the basis of its possibility. Those open-minded investigators who are willing to accept its fundamentals as a working hypothesis until these are demonstrated to be erroneous. They will be frankly agnostic. A Treatise on White Magic, 1971, A Rig, 1934, pp. 6, 32. To keep the chronology of the guides and mentors in my life, the relevant name here is Riley Grab, Director of Borderland Sciences Research Foundation, BSRF, 1959, 1985. But as I have written rather extensively on Riley in earlier blog entries, interested readers are referred to these blogs. Instead, I wish to present the ufologist and author Timothy Good, who has been a great inspiration and friend for many years. Rather early in my ufological career, I lamented the fact that so few of the classic contactees of the 1950s had been thoroughly and seriously studied and their experiences documented. Scientific ufologists usually dismissed these individuals as cranks and cultists, without further investigation. Many contactees, of course, belonged to the rogue and crackpot category, but there were, in my opinion, a few intriguing exceptions: George Adamski, Orfeo Angelosi, Daniel Fry, George Van Tassel, Howard Menger, AO activists in the 1950s and 60s UFO and New Age community were usually either rather naive believers or debunkers on the issue of contactees. There were few open-minded, serious investigators looking into the contactee enigma. This situation began to change in the 1980s with the publication of George Adamski, The Untold Story, written by Lou Zinstag and Timothy Good, 1983. Finally, a study that was neither a hagiography nor a debunking dismissal, but a careful weighing up of the evidence for and against this controversial man. After reading and reviewing the book in 1983, I immediately wrote to Timothy Good expressing my appreciation of their research. Isn't it peculiar that the first actual biography on Adamski should be written by Europeans? Where are the American UFO detectives? I received a very kind reply, and since then we have kept the correspondence going all these years. Timothy Good has provided me with many interesting documents, transcripts of interviews, photographs and data relating to his worldwide investigation of contactee cases. We have compared data and discussed all the tricky issues of this fascinating enigma. In my first letter to Timothy, I presented my theory regarding secret brotherhoods on Earth and UFOs, the esoteric intervention theory. Here a quote from Tim's reply, dated February 27, 1984, "Let me discuss your fascinating theory, which, as you correctly point out, is not a new one. It may please you to learn that Howard Menger, with whom I spent a lot of time in 1978, shares your view. He does not now believe that the people he met, and meet them he did, of that I am certain, came from Venus and Mars, Saturn, etc. He thinks it far more likely that they come from a superior civilization here on Earth that has existed for thousands of years, but may use Venus and Mars as bases, since they obviously have space flight capability." The book by Lou Zinstag and Timothy Good in many ways reopened the George Adamski case and inspired renewed investigative efforts to understand contact experiences. A more open-minded view on contactees had earlier been presented by American ufologist Ed Blocher at the first International UFO Congress in 1980. George Adamski, The Untold Story contain a mass of new data and insights into the controversial claims of this the first generation contactee. Timothy Good is not, like Desmond Leslie, an esotericist, but his theories and conclusions relating to the experiences of Adamski and other contactees are in line with the esoteric tradition. Referring to the extraordinary feats of yogis like Paramahansa Yogananda, he concludes, "It is my conviction that many extraterrestrials are capable of these and other even more fantastic feats. Indeed, I see little difference in this respect between highly evolved human beings on this planet and those from many other. These abilities are precisely what we should expect." 197. Timothy Good also expressed a deep fascination with individuals like Comte de Saint-Germain, Cagliostro and Anton Mesmer, and finds it likely they were associated with the ancient races. Earth. An Alien Enterprise, p. 405, 406. From an esoteric aspect, there is an interesting point made by Luzenstag, relating to the rather doubtful claim that Adamski had some private tuition in Tibet at an early age. I suspect that the young boy must have enjoyed tuition by a teacher or guide, connected with a group in Tibet, as he subsequently founded the Royal Order of Tibet. P. 5. Could Adamski, at an early age, have been contacted by a Tibetan teacher, similar to the experiences of Milan Kuk, who wrote the prophetic article Son of the Sun in 1947? One of my favorite books by Timothy Good is Alien Base, 1998, a comprehensive account of physical contactee cases documented by the author during his worldwide travels. Here we find the remarkable contact experiences of Joel Marchamont, a good friend of Timothy Good for many years. In a letter in 1984, I asked why he regarded her as reliable. My contactee friend. Why reliable? I have known her since 1952 and can vouch for her integrity. She has never tried to capitalize on the story, and, indeed, is unable to discuss all the details, due partly to the ET's ability to control her memory of certain things they told her, and also because she was in the Maquis, French resistance, in the last war, and thus is able to keep some information to herself. Letter August 28, 1984. To mainstream serious ufologists, Timothy Good is probably best known by his classic studies above Top Secret, 1987, and Need to Know, UFOs, the Military and Intelligence, 2006. He has for many years lectured worldwide, and several of these lectures can be found at YouTube. As a professional violinist and a member of the London Symphony Orchestra for 14 years, he has worked together with famous musicians as George Harrison, Elton John, Paul McCartney and U2. A rather unique combination of talents and achievements. The latest book was published in 2013, Earth, an Alien Enterprise, which I reviewed in an earlier blog entry. Chapter 11 is a summary of the Swedish Richard Hoglund case, which I spent many years documenting and has discussed extensively with Timothy. We have sometimes differed in opinion on the veracity of various contactees. One example is the controversial Amasisia story from Italy, of which I have grave doubts. But most of the time during our years of correspondence we have reached similar conclusions on cases investigated. Reading and listening to Timothy Good is a stimulating adventure and intellectual challenge. You may not always agree with his ideas and theories, but he has done what serious ufologists neglected to do, to thoroughly investigate and document the first generation contactees and their experiences. Because of this interest, he is sort of a heretic among the scientific ufologists and skeptics who continue investigating the easily explained lights in the sky instead of going after the real enigma, the close encounters and contact experiences. It was very much with the help of Timothy Good that I was able to elaborate an extended version of Valley's esoteric intervention theory. In this respect, he has been an important guide and mentor, of which I am eternally grateful. In my life, I have met many interesting and extraordinary personalities. Some have been basically mentors and others both friends and mentors. In this last category, I include the Couplester and Tara Johnson, often mentioned in older blog entries. I first met Stur and Turid in late autumn 1972, and we immediately became very good friends. They freely shared their many and sometimes frightening UFO and close encounters. The rather unusual and varied experiences of Stur and Turid was what actually inspired me to begin in-depth investigations of the often complicated and controversial physical contactee cases. Foremost, the enigma of Richard Hoglund. Stur and Tara Johnson had been involved in UFO and spiritualist circles for several years before I met them. They were spiritual searchers studying different teachers and traditions. After a lecture at Stockholm's UFO Center in 1973, Stur and Tara began meditation meetings at their home in Lidingö, Stockholm, with a group of members from the UFO Society. In November 1973, I was invited to attend these meditation sessions. We met every Friday night for about 3 years and became a very tightly knit group and close friends. For me, this group was especially important as I was troubled by personal problems during the spring of 1974. We all became fellow spiritual seekers in the meditation group, studying A.O. Helena Blavatsky, Rudolf Steiner, and discussing all aspects of philosophy and paranormal phenomena. These were joyous and inspiring gatherings. Although the subjects discussed were serious, we often joked heartily and rather irreverently about spiritual teachers and ourselves. As almost all of us were active in various UFO, parapsychological and spiritual organizations, we referred to our group as the Occult Mafia. We often gathered together at holidays, New Year's Eve and other occasions. We had summer parties, visiting lectures, exhibitions and interesting persons among our acquaintances. One evening we spontaneously decided to place our meditation session deep in the forest, a few Swedish miles south of Stockholm, at a place called Paradise at the Paradise. After having walked in the dark forest for about a mile, we arrived at a small lake, Dreihorningen. There the group settled together, meditating and gazing at the beautiful night sky filled with stars and occasional meteors. It was an awe-inspiring evening full of magical beauty and mystery. Many times later we gathered at this place for recreation and bathing in the lake, a few times sleeping in a lap cot or teepee built close to the lake. I came to know Stroktora Jonsson very well, and we spent many evenings at my small one-room apartment in Sundbyberg, discussing and trying to understand the many facets of the UFO enigma, and of course their own close encounters and contacts. Often during these evenings we were joined by our good friend Ak Franzen, one of the few Swedes to have personally investigated the famous Mothmen in West Virginia. Ak was a volcano of good spirits coupled with an intense thirst for knowledge of all aspects of UFO and paranormal phenomena. Our gatherings were full of joy and laughter and will forever be cherished in my memory. A seminal event occurred during our meditation meeting on November 19, 1976. Tirad told the group that Stur had recently begun going into a trance state and a spirit, Simono, had started talking through him. Although members of the group had read about many paranormal events, we were all somewhat apprehensive when Stur started to gasp and shake, raised up, and a completely foreign voice came from his lips. The voice greeted us and told us not to be afraid. The trance communications marked the beginning of the end for the meditation group. Stroktora Jonsson became more and more involved in spreading the messages from Simono, and later an old Egyptian calling himself Ambers. In 1976-1977 I participated in several trance sessions at the home of Stroktora and had many long conversations with Ambers. I taped these sessions and they became important as they taught me a lot of how trance communication works and the problem of interpretation. The teachings of Ambers became very popular and soon a group formed around the couple. In the 1980s Stroktora moved to the north of Värmland, building a center attracting many followers who came from all over the world to listen to the Ambers teachings. Stur became very famous in the 1980s when celebrities like Shirley MacLaine and Dennis Weaver visited the center in Sweden. Stur and Trid traveled around the world and I have letters and postcards posted from California, Hawaii and Mexico. Stur also figures in the miniseries Out on a Limb from 1987, based on the best-selling book by Shirley MacLaine. It was perhaps inevitable that our meditation group should split up and the members chose different paths in life. The group had served its purpose and our respective dharma made us chose different roads and spiritual traditions. For me, the way ahead meant an extensive study of the esoteric tradition, especially Henry T. Lorenzi and Alice Bailey. Article from the Swedish Daily Express on November 26, 1985. When Shirley MacLaine visited Stur Jonsson listening to the taped trance sessions and reading the books written by Stur Jonsson, I noticed very early that the teachings of Ambers reflected the ideas we had discussed in the meditation group and corresponded clearly to the personal philosophy of Stur and Tirad, a mixture of mysticism, spiritualism and theosophy. Nothing really new came from Ambers. Tirad was very much influenced by the doctrine of mentalism, a form of Advaita's objectivism stating that material reality only exists in our minds. In the words of Embers, the first four dimensions exist only if someone experiences them. The beholder is man. It is you who have created this room. We also find statements like, "This is not a teaching you should cultivate with your intellect, we should never compare teachings." I state this not as debunking criticism because the teachings are in many respects inspiring, beautiful and have probably helped many people to a more positive life view. There is no fanaticism, life, negating asceticism or political extremism presented. What would be my interpretation of the teachings and identity of Embers today? Although the word esoteric is sometimes used in the teachings, the philosophy presented is not esoteric, except with regard to some basic ideas. The intellectual and scholarly esotericist would immediately notice the differences. Besides this fact, the adepts or the planetary guardians never use trans-channelers with no control of who is communicating. To understand this phenomenon from an esoteric viewpoint, I use my standard reference works in the multiverse science. A very good presentation and reasonable explanation can be found in two books by Alice Bailey. Students should read From Intellect to Intuition, pp. 243-249, cloth-bound ed. Here are a few quotes relative to the problem of meditation and entity communication. Again, some force, a word frequently used, or some entity comes to the student, as he meditates, and outlines to him some great work that he has been chosen to do, some world message that he has to give and to which the whole world is to listen. Should an apparition appear to him, therefore, and should such an entity make platitudinous comments, he will use the same judgment as he would in business or ordinary life. He will probably laugh and continue with the activity or duty of the moment. The world of illusion is full of these thought forms, constructed by the loving thoughts of men down the ages. Regarding channeled messages, some further information is found. Telepathy by Alice Bailey, pp. 75-77, these messages are normally innocuous, sometimes beautiful. Because they are a mixture of what the recipients have read and gathered from Christian sources and the Bible. From the viewpoint of the esoteric tradition, the identity of Embers could be either a subconsciously created fantasy personality or an astral entity masquerading as an Egyptian sage. Stir and Tirid eventually separated while Stir continues his work and teachings in Varmland with a new partner. Thread died in October 2010. She will always stay in my memory, and I cherish the Varm friendship and many joyous meetings we had together. In several respects, both Stir and Tirid became my teachers and mentors, and I am grateful for our time together. 6. UFO Contactees, Case Histories. Mark Hallett, A Critical Appraisal of George Adamski. Mention the name George Adamski among serious scientific ufologists and you will without hesitation get comments like, liar, fraud, cultist, charlatan, etc. without much argumentation. What scientific ufologists fail to recognize is that this kind of emotional response is simply a reflection of the naive New Age ufologists who already know the answer without investigation. Mere criticism is not enough. You must have facts. It was therefore with great anticipation I received the latest book by Mark Hallett, A Critical Appraisal of George Adamski. The Man Who Spoke to the Space Brothers, written in collaboration with American ufologist Richard Hayden. The book is free for download on the internet. Mark Hallett has generously donated his large Adamski files to AFU, an important and invaluable collection of material for future research. In many ways, Mark and I have the same background in ufology. We were born in 1952 and entered our ufological careers by being rather naive Adamski fans. Mark working together with Belgian Adamski Co. workers May and Keith Flitcroft. And we both, after a few years, discovered the problems with Adamski and became much more critical of his books and claims. For Mark, this discovery entered a lifelong investigation of George Adamski, resulting in several books, mostly in French. For me, a 40-plus year investigation of both foreign and Swedish contact experiences, including the controversial first-generation American contactees. As I value intellectual honesty, I find it important, before I continue my review, to state that my personal views on Adamski differs in several respects from Hallett. Readers of my latest book and blog are aware of that I present an alternative theory, a variant of Valley's esoteric intervention theory.